Thank you very much, Olaf. I perhaps have to explain a bit my position. It's true, since 2013, I'm Advocate General at the Supreme Court in the Netherlands. Advocate General there, I'm only dealing with criminal law, but has a bit sort of same position as the Advocate General at the ECJ, in the sense that we are giving independent opinions in cases where the Supreme Court has to make a decision. And part-time, I'm still, but very part-time, a professor of criminal law at Maastricht University. And I have been until 2013 criminal defense lawyer too. And well, we have had projects as Ed Cape already referred to, which have, we have done a lot of comparative research with regard to the position of the defense and procedural safeguards. And well, I'm going to set out for you the basics of the directive on the right to information. I will go into a few practicalities too, because of the research we have done, and I think later on that will fit very good with the presentation that comes next. I had a bit of same idea, and this telepathy, Ed, perhaps you had a case. I just wanted to paint you a scene of daily practice in a Dutch police station in a way how information is given to somebody who is arrested at a police station. We've done some empirical research, and there have been researchers sitting in police stations for a considerable time, for a few months also in the Netherlands, and they have observed this, and I will just give you this narrative of what happened here. You can see the arrested person is lying in his cell, and this is actually the narrative of what happened. The assistant prosecutor comes into the cell, and seeing that the suspect appears to be sleeping, his face into the pillow, he says, "Hello," in a very loud voice, as the suspect does not react. The assistant prosecutor says, "Hello," again, even louder, and then he raises his head and says, "May I go home now?" The assistant prosecutor says, "No, he cannot go home. He will have to stay longer," and the suspect doesn't react anymore and puts his face in the pillow again. Then the assistant prosecutor says, "It's a police officer. Now you must listen to me." And the suspect raises his head again. "I'm an officer of justice, and I'm here to tell you about your rights. Do you understand?" "Yeah." The assistant prosecutor says, "Do you know why you were arrested?" "Because I'm drunk." And the police officer says, "You did not comply with the order of the police. Did you know that this is a crime in the Netherlands?" The suspect was coming from the United Kingdom. "So, I can't remember anything. Can I please go home?" the suspect answers. "You have to pay first. I'm here to give you your rights." He informs him about the right to silence. And because of his rather poor English, the assistant prosecutor says, "You're not obliged to ask questions instead of saying answer questions." And about the right to consult with a lawyer, the assistant prosecutor starts to explain that in the Netherlands, you can have a lawyer for free before the police asks questions. This is a new rule. He goes on to explain that there was a Saldus decision of the European Court, etc., and the suspect doesn't seem to be able to follow this story at all. "Do you want to speak with a lawyer?" "No, I just want to be released," the suspect says. Then the assistant prosecutor tells the suspect he has the opportunity to pay and go home. Does he agree to do that? And the suspect seems to hesitate. He asks, "How much would that be? How much would I have to pay?" It depends on the decision of the officer of justice. Then the suspect tells him that he does not know how much money he has. Then the assistant prosecutor tells him that they found about 300 euros on him when they arrested him. The suspect seems to be surprised. It was so much. But he says, well, that's all I have. And this is how it continues, and what you can see is the way how here the suspect was given his rights, the information on his rights. It happens often in the police cell, but also how important it is in what kind of situation these rights are given. This is happening in the Netherlands very often, that what you see is that there is a giving of the rights, there is a sort of questioning at the same time, even before the lawyer arrives, and then there is a possibility to pay a fine, which is called a penal order, and the suspect can decide to pay this fine and then go home. So what you see is there's made a decision. It's possible that there is a decision made in the end of this police interview. Okay, what I want to deliberate with you on is the right to information in criminal proceedings. And this right to information can be divided sort of in three parts. It's first, we already discussed this, is information on the charge. What is the suspect? What kind of behavior he is suspected of, what is the crime. Access to the file, this is information that probably the police possibly already has available, evidence, and information on rights. So there are three different aspects on it. What is the situation if we look at the right to this information according to the international conventions like the European Convention on Human Rights, you can see that there is no general provision on information on rights in the European Convention on Human Rights as such. The rights are written in there, but there is no provision where it's explicitly provided that a suspect should get information on them. What you can find is from the Strasbourg case law, if you look into it, is that you can find in certain decisions, you can find information as to what kind of information on rights perhaps could be given. And if you look at the Strasbourg case law, you can see, for instance, I just give you a few I give you the case law, but there is more on it. But there, the first point is that there should be an active attitude required from the authorities to inform suspects, for instance, on free legal aid. There is an explicit decision on that. And then from another case, it's the case of Pishalnikov, you can read into it that the question there was whether Pishalnikov waived his right to speak to a lawyer, that the waiver is only legally possible or without violation of Article 6 of the Convention if this waiver takes place knowingly. So that means that it's implicit in this decision that the police should inform suspects on their right to a lawyer before, and inform also what the consequences are if the suspect doesn't want a lawyer, in order to accept that this right can be waived. The same applies, for instance, to the access of to information, the access to evidence. There is, of course, Strasbourg case law on disclosure, on access to the evidence in the file, but it's all more related to the phase of pretrial detention, proceedings during pretrial detention, or in the trial phase. There is not really any case law indicating as from which moment this access to the file or access to information starts, and whether it starts already, for instance, in the phase of the police interrogation or even before that. And then with regard to the right to silence and the privilege against self-incrimination, it's clear that from Article 6 derives that somebody has to be, before a police interrogation starts, if somebody is suspected of a criminal offence, he has to be cautioned on his right to silence. So these rights can be derived from the European Convention of Human Rights. Then there is another issue that is also addressed in the directive, and that's the question of medical care. There has also been discussion whether somebody who is at the police station should be informed of the right to see a doctor, for instance, in the very first phase of the police detention, and whether they should also be informed of a remedy to challenge the legality of the detention. Is it possible to go to court and be released when you're arrested? From Article 3 of the European Convention on Human Rights, because there is no other article a right to medical care derives from, that imposes a positive obligation on authorities to ensure that a person's health and well-being is cared for. So the right to a doctor in a police detention, for instance, can be derived from this article. And the same applies for the right to have information to challenge the legality of the detention. This derives from Article 5, Paragraph 4 of the European Convention that you can seek judicial review. When you are detained, and that is applicable as derives from Strasbourg case law, that as soon as a person is deprived of his liberty. Then there are rights to information can also be derived from other international sources. I'm just going quickly through these because I want to return to the directive later. What can be derived from Article 14, paragraph 3 of the ICCPR. There it is written, and as it's not in Article 6 of the European Convention, that there is a right for the suspect to be informed on the right to legal assistance. What you can also see is that it derives from CPT standards, European prison rules, the UN Convention Against Torture, and especially of the reports of the CAT, the Committee Against Torture, and the United Nations Standard Minimum Rules for the Treatment of Prisoners. In all these sort of international regulations, conventions, you can find traces of what kind of rights to be informed of a suspect has. But I think the directive enhances these rights and gives it a more practical regulations how to implement it. The directive itself it is from the date of 22 May of 2012, and the transposition date has already also transpired. It was the 2nd June of 2014. The following scope. Ed Cabe already talked about, but you can see the same structure in this directive as is, has been in the directive on interpretation and translation, that it applies in the situation of a criminal charge, and Ed Cabe has already addressed that what is a criminal charge, there can be discussion about it, and there is a derogation for minor offences. For instance, if somebody is arrested or held by the police for a traffic offence, where there can be no detention imposed, or when pretrial detention cannot be imposed, in that kind of situation, it's possible that the directive does not apply at all. And it, of course, it applies in the European arrest warrant cases. And if we're going to look on what kind of rights then the suspect should be informed of, it's first of all, access to a lawyer, to free legal advice. It should give information on the accusation, which is derived from Article 6, that is the reasons for the arrest, interpretation and translation, and the right to remain silent. These are the points that a suspect should be informed of. And then Article 4 of the directive gives additional rights when there is deprivation of liberty, because all these other rights apply also when somebody is going voluntarily to the police station or is not in pretrial detention, is access to the file, and that consular authorities should be informed, and that an additional person, could be a family member or a spouse or whatever, should be informed. And there you see, here you see also that should be informed on medical assistance. The maximum hours of detention, because that is something I think Ed Cape tried to trigger with his case study. If you are arrested here by a police officer and taken to the police station, of course, one of the issues you really want to know is how long can they keep me here? And I'm going to deliberate a bit more on that, that it should be presented, all these rights should be given in simple language. And you see in the directive that there has also been a model developed on how this information should be given, especially with regard to what kind of language could be used. And then I think the third important issue is the access to the material of the case. And here you get again the discussion on what the definition should be of what is material of the case. Ed Cape deliberated also on that issue, is that, for instance, is this the information that is given in the case that is important to make a decision, for instance, for the court in order to apply pretrial detention? Is that enough? Or should there be given much more information, like the evidence the police has when they arrest a person? I think that is the question is, and that will be, I think, there will be a lot of litigation on this when this really is implemented in the national jurisdictions, is what is the definition, what kind of materials should be given according to this directive. It should be, of course, material essential to challenge the lawfulness of the detention, but this is a very broad definition. There are derogations, of course, because there are lots of jurisdictions who say, well, we cannot give all the information that is at the disposal of the police, because then we would give away a lot of information that could be used to obstruct the investigation in the case. Copies should be given free of charge, and what is important also, that there should be a procedure, a remedy, to challenge the refusal of giving information on the material of the case. So there should be in each transposition, in each national jurisdiction, there should be a procedure how to challenge a refusal that when the material is not given. Ed talked about this before. We have done in two studies, we have done sort of research on how information to suspects are given in the pretrial procedure, and especially at the police station. And I've conducted a study in 2010 that was before the directive has come into force, and that also, I think, was used to see what kind of rights should be given information on in the directive, and that was a study of 2010. What we discovered there is that in 2010, of all EU member states, there were 17 EU member states who were giving in a sort of brochure or standardized way information to suspects who were detained at the police station. And the main rights that were given information on also sort of are now in the directive. And then we had a follow-up study, that was where I gave you the little story about how a person who was arrested at the police station in the Netherlands was informed by the police. That is a study of inside police custody where we actually looked how these rights are, how this information is actually given at the police station and what kind of problems arise. I think one of the things we came across in the 2010 study is that if information is given in writing, it's often very dependent on how this is given. So the directive is stating that there should be information given in writing, and this should be in an easily understandable language. But what I saw of a later study, it's in your material, it's the TRAINAC study, where it has been, there was a questionnaire sent out to all member states on how this letter of rights looks like. And what we see is that the same problems arise coming out of this study as were the problems that were already before the directive, what we have already seen as a problem. For instance, letters of rights which were given in a layout and in a language that lay people who are arrested at the police station, it's this it looks like wallpaper, I think, it's very difficult to read, to understand. It's the legal provisions that are given, and often it's also much more information than that the suspect needs at the moment when he's arrested at the police station. So these letters of rights is very important, and that is a bit, I think, the same situation which was addressed this morning, that if somebody, I think you told us, somebody who is already living for a long time in Germany, the Italian pizza baker, and well, he needs also interpretation when he's arrested at the police station because he's not aware of the legal language. And I think the same sort of situation applies also to, even if you are a native speaker, even if you can speak the language of the country you're living in, even then, in that situation, it's very, very difficult for a lay person to understand the legal issues that are at stake. And when we did this study in 2010, in order to try to sort of gather all the information that was put into the letters of right and how this was phrased, first we thought this is a very easy exercise. You know, you put all the rights the suspect has in a letter, and that's all you need. But then you see that the language matters. How are you going to put this into a letter of rights? And for instance, what we saw is that in the UK, and I think in you see here also on the other side, a letter of rights from Scotland, there has been given much more thought as to how to formulate this, how to put this, how to write this down in order to make also a layperson understand what is at stake. And what I've understood is that from a psychological point of view, you have to write a text that a 12-year-old can understand also for adults. Otherwise, it remains unclear what is meant. So you see, a sort of best practice example is that remember your rights is also more inviting than the other example I'm giving here. I think it was the previous of the Czech Republic that I took this off. Then you have the right to know why the police are holding you in custody. You have the right to know what the police suspects you have done, the right to speak to a lawyer in private. Well, this is much clearer than the other example. And what I've seen from the TRAINAC study is that this is still a problem, even after the directive has come into force and has been transposed, that there are a lot of EU member states who are still having a letter of rights in too complicated wording, the legal provisions, that, well, I have not sort of thought of putting it into a simpler language. There are also other problems with the letter of rights. What I've read from this TRAINAC study, which we also see, is that, for instance, not in all countries all rights are included. What I thought, the Irish letter of rights, for instance, doesn't mention the right to silence, which is, I think, is a very important issue to inform a suspect on. And they don't do that because the right to silence, I don't know if you know the caution in Ireland, is rather complicated because the suspect is told, Ed, correct me if I'm wrong, because I always get this. I even think it's very complicated. They say you have the right to remain silent, but if you rely later on some evidence or on a statement you haven't given in the previous phase, this can be used against you in the sense that adverse inferences can be drawn from that. So essentially, if you keep silent, it could be interpreted later on, if you give a statement later on what happened, in a negative sense, that it could be used as evidence against you. This is, of course, very complicated to inform a suspect who is not aware of what the complications are of this caution. So then it's said, well, okay, you can speak to a lawyer, and then the lawyer can explain to you what the consequences are of invoking your right to silence. Well, what I want to say is, and I think that is very important because I think the directive in itself is rather straightforward, but what you see is that it's very important, and we already discussed this on the previous directive on interpretation, that practicalities are taken into account. There have to be, I think, rather precise regulations on how the information is given. For instance, like the narrative or the story I gave you in the beginning, do you think that this information should be given to somebody who is drunk, lying in a police station, and then the police is coming into his cell and telling him, listen, you have the right to talk to a lawyer? What we have seen in our research with the Adan also is that the timing when this is told is very important. For instance, French practice was at the time that we did this research, is that the suspect is informed of these rights at the moment that he is arrested. It's sort of comparable with the Miranda warnings. We all know it from television. Somebody is, you know, he is arrested at the street, and then he is told by the police immediately, you have the right to remain silent, and you have the right to a lawyer, etc. And one of the lawyers we interviewed in that research said also that if you are pinned down by the police with your nose on the street and your hands held in the back, and then told that you have the right to remain silent and you have the right to consult a lawyer, we don't really know if the mind of the suspect works properly in the sense that he can understand that in this stressful situation. So it has to be thought of very carefully on how this provision of these rights are regulated. There should be, I think, checklist and prescribed words also in how the, for instance, a suspect is informed of his right to silence or his right to a lawyer. And as I already told, the language is very important. One of the questions is also whether the directive states that this these rights should be given in writing, so by a letter of rights, but also a suspect should also be informed orally whether he understands these rights. And what you see from practice, I also take some examples from this Trainac research that is in your material, but what we very much have seen also in the research Ed and I have conducted is that, for instance, police officers speak very quickly. They just want to get through to give this information in order to start with the interrogation. And in the oral versions, they just summarize the rights that are given in writing, perhaps a bit more in detail. And what I think is very, other examples are that the suspect is given this information just before the interrogation starts. So he has not even allowing a time to make a decision whether he wants the lawyer, whether he wants to remain silent or not. And so it's often this information on rights is sort of a ticking a box in a form of the recording of the statement, and it's quickly told to the suspect what his rights are, and then the duty of the interrogating or the interviewing police officer has been performed, and they can just start on with the interrogation. So timing is also very important. We have seen one good practice in Belgium, where, for instance, the suspect is given this information in writing and also orally, but because the suspect needs to talk with a lawyer before the interrogation can start and cannot waive his right to a lawyer without talking to a lawyer first, there's always a time in between providing these rights and that the lawyer arrives. So there is a time to think about the information that was given. Is that correct? Yeah, you say. So that is, I think, a better way to provide these rights. Another point, of course, is the question of interpretation. Ed already told you that the interpretation of the letter of rights in some jurisdictions is available. I think in the UK it's more than 50 languages. In other countries, there's less. What I know from the Netherlands that there are only 8 or 12 languages, in 8 or 12 languages, this letter of rights is available. But what you also see is that it differs very much. I don't know what your experience is in practice from police station to police station. We have, there are police stations in the Netherlands where this letter of rights is always given. It's always also explained orally. And there are police stations that they don't even know where you're talking about. So if you ask where is the letter of rights, they don't know it. One practice we saw in Sweden is that they said, well, we have a letter of rights, yes, and the lawyers told us, yes, the letter of rights is there, but it's in the corridor of the cell block. So suspects probably have to read this while being transported to their cells. So if it is said that this information is given, you have to really to look into the practice and how this is done. And another important issue is, of course, and that is what Ed also has emphasized, is that these rights are for the suspects, and it should not be dealt with as if it's a formality you have to go through, and then you can get on with the investigation. So there should be a sort of genuine commitment to inform, and that is very much dependent on the attitude of the police officer and also of the lawyers, because lawyers also tend to skip this information and get on with trying to get information from the client or whatever. What we have seen is that lawyers don't really check whether their clients have been informed and have received these letters of rights. And of course, the attitude of the police is also in many jurisdictions a problem. There is a pitfall of routinely, you know, giving this information, not really thinking, does this person which is now sitting before me, is it somebody who is, for instance, experienced, has been arrested before, knows what happened, or is it a first-time offender? Is it a minor? Is it somebody who has, in another way, difficulties of understanding what is going on? So there must be an understanding of the position of the detained suspect, and what also have to be kept in mind is that there is a certain interrelation of these rights, all the rights that are given information on. I think these are really important issues to address. What I just want to finish with is that we have seen one best practice, actually, from England and Wales, and that is how suspects are informed when they come into the police station, which is called the custody suite. It's often, the suite is a nice name for it. It's often a very, very small place. But what is important in the first place is that the police officer responsible for that the suspect is given his rights and is informed over his rights, and to check whether the suspect is in the condition to be, for instance, to be interviewed, or if legal or medical assistance needs to be called. That's the responsibility of the custody officer. And I think what we have not seen in other jurisdictions is that it is his sole responsibility. So this is a police officer who is not responsible for the investigation in the case, which is very important. I think police officers who want to go on with the case have a lot of pressure, want to get a confession, for instance, from their clients. They have an interest in the way how they inform clients on their right to silence. So this is done in not in a cell, but in this custody suite where suspect is brought before the custody officer. And what we have seen also from these talks they have is that this custody officer is trained also to check whether the suspect has understood what he has told him. And there is a very easy trick to do that, that is informing somebody you have the right to a lawyer. No, I don't want a lawyer, I want to go home. Or you have this or this right. You can say, why don't you want a lawyer? It's important to have a lawyer. Do you know what is at stake for you at this moment? Or if there is a more complicated information given, could you repeat to me, the suspect, to the police officer, what I have told you, in order to check whether the information that was given has been understood? What also happened in England and Wales is when the lawyer arrives at a police station, he gets information from the police officer who is dealing with the case and gets some information on what kind of evidence they have. So there is, for the lawyer, he's in a position when he's going to consult with his client before the interview to have some information on what is at stake, what kind of evidence there is at the table, in order to be able to discuss that with his client, who has to make decisions on what kind of strategy will be taken in this police interview, and whether the client decides to remain silent or is given a statement. So I think this could serve as an example in for providing rights in other jurisdictions. And according to me, what I read from the TRAINAC study, there are lots of examples given that there can be a lot of things can be improved in this respect.